Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, you're listening to the Politics Without the Boring Bits podcast with me, Patrick Maguire, in for Matt Chorley. Today we're talking about borders and why they're more than just lines on a map. Open your atlas and you can find any given squiggle that explains why our politics is in the state that it's in. I'll be discussing that with John Ellis, the author of a fascinating new book on the subject, after we speak to two of our favourite columnists on everything from Nigel Farage's birthday party to whether you're going to notice Jeremy Hunt's tax cuts.
The Columnists.
Yes, it's a Friday, so Indian night is here. Hello, India.
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
I'm fantastic, India. It's not a sunny day, but I'm feeling pretty sunny today. And James is here as well, but it's not James Marriott. He's interrailing, living out his long adolescence, James Marriott. Instead, we've got an even better James. Don't tell James Marriott. Well, he won't be listening because he doesn't have a smartphone anymore. James Heal from The Spectator, the political correspondent of The Spectator, is here. How are you, James?
I'm good, thank you, Patrick.
Well, I'm sure you're hungover, but we'll talk about that in a little moment. First, though, we're going to talk about tax cuts. The government's national insurance cut of 10% to 8% comes into force over the weekend. It's worth about £450 a year to an employee on an average salary of £35,000. Here's the Treasury Minister, Gareth Davis, who told Times Radio Breakfast his party is committed to reducing tax.
We have been very clear that we want to get the tax burn down. We want to cut tax on work, and that's what we're doing.
So that was Gareth Davis, the Treasury Minister. It's an interesting question, this, India, isn't it? Because the government are making so much noise about these tax cuts. They've cut national insurance twice in the past 6 months. But do you think anybody is going to notice? Is this going to touch the sides when inflation is still ticking up, albeit at a slower rate, and everything seems to be more expensive? Are the government going to get any credit for this?
Everything's still broken and people are, of course, paying more tax. I think people will notice. I think people in this bracket will notice £450 a year is a considerable amount of money. But everything feels to me like the government is treading water before their exit. And so things that ought to feel like good news and uplifting and, OK, we can, you know, this is a good thing, we can work with this, just sort of fall away and lie there sadly by the wayside, it feels like to me. But, I mean, certainly, if you're within that bracket, you will feel the difference. So that's a good thing. But yeah, it won't be noticed. Well, it won't be registered as a good thing, I don't think.
Indeed. And as you say, India, you know, there's been a freeze. The ongoing freeze in income tax levels means that until 2028, people who are getting pay rises are going to be dragged into the higher tax bracket. Mm. So what they get from the government in this national insurance cut may well be taken away from them with an income tax rise. I mean, and that's going to be the test for Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt, isn't it, James? Whether at the end of this month, because it's interesting, they brought this in April rather than waiting a little bit longer. They've sort of rushed forward this
tax cut. They cut it in January. It's cut again in April. The test will be whether people at the end of this month look at their payslips or look at their bank balances and say, "Ah, I've got £350 there. That's a turn up for the books," or whether it all disappears into higher energy bills, higher food bills, etc.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what India says there. I mean, there's a sense perhaps of taking one with one hand and giving with another. And I do think what's striking is that often the government gets blamed for the bad economic news, but none of the credit for the good ones. So this week, for instance, we see state pension rate going up. We see the minimum wage going up by another pound. And you've got, of course, the national insurance cut. And yet, if you look at the polls, for instance, there seems to be very little avoidance of anything over the past year or so, really. And I mean, talking to pollsters, they use this phrase of news avoidance. The public is actually sort of tuned out of a lot of these debates. Mm. Certainly, there's just a sense, perhaps, when everything isn't going the government's way, they just can't seem to find the kind of political momentum and get the credits for things they are doing on tax, for instance. So some people will notice it, but whether they actually choose to reward the Conservatives at the ballot box is quite another question.
Yeah, that is the problem. And I think you've put your finger on something quite important there, James, which is when Rishi Sunak now appears on TV, and you're right, we hear this from focus groups on Times Radio all the time, you see it in polls, they sort of have stopped listening to the Prime Minister, and that's a pretty dangerous place for him to be, isn't it, India?
Yeah, I think judgment has been passed, and something very, very dramatic would have to happen now at this late stage for the judgment to be reversed. And I almost feel sorry for them, for him. You know, that there doesn't seem to be anything that the government can do that even registers. I'm interested in the news avoidance thing that James just mentioned. I think people have just zoned out and they're just waiting for the next thing to happen. And this thing has been consigned to the bin, frankly, it feels like.
Well, nobody has passed harsher judgment on the Prime Minister than some of the voters who voted for the Tories in 2019 and are now looking at Reform UK. We got analysis in the Times this morning from Redbox editor Laura Spirit of that major poll from YouGov we had earlier in the week projecting a Labour landslide, but it found that Reform UK, while they don't win any seats themselves, are predicted to cost the Conservatives 41 seats. The poll projected Labour would win 403, but if Reform weren't fielding candidates, that would drop to 374. James, when you look at stats like this, you think those Tory MPs, those government sources who briefed the paper this earlier in the week, who say the only person who benefits from a Reform vote is Keir Starmer, definitely have a point, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. But I think, first of all, it depends if anyone is listening to that as an argument. And I think second of all, is that this is very different from 2019, when the Brexit Party was under enormous pressure to stand down its candidates, first of all, to save Brexit, but second of all, to keep Jeremy Corbyn out. And this time, there aren't those kind of factors. Keir Starmer isn't as scary as Jeremy Corbyn was. There isn't a kind of great democratic mission to this government or imperative that would convince Reform to stand them down. And so Reform will end up costing the Tories quite a few number of seats, just like last time. They didn't stand down their candidates in those kind of northern air seats which were held by Labour. So people like Ed Miliband, Yvette Cooper might have lost their seats last time had Reform, or Brexit Party as it was back then, stood in those seats. So I think this time they could cost the Tories dozens of seats, but they don't look like winning any of them. And so it would be more about splitting the Tory vote rather than actually, putting forward a constructive agenda themselves.
And it's the Tories sort of suffering death by a thousand cuts almost on both sides, India. I imagine where you are in Suffolk, right? It's not so much Reform UK, although I'm sure there's a bit of that. But, you know, in places like Suffolk, it's the Tories are having the same problem with the Greens. It's sort of both ends of their coalition are sort of being winnowed away. And while they won't necessarily end up with loads of seats, those two parties, it's the Labour Party that's going to benefit from every person that doesn't vote Tory.
It's really interesting, the situation here. I find it fascinating. It was proper true blue Tory. Then it was very, very Brexity. I'm surrounded by farmers. I live quite remotely. Then it was very, very Brexity and people were really fired up and pro-Brexit. Then the farmers have suffered. What the farmers expected to happen didn't happen. And the Greens are very much in the ascendant. And it's really interesting. It's really interesting. I'll be fascinated at a general election to see what happens.
Well, we'll see whether Nigel Farage coming back to lead Reform changes the dynamic. His 60th birthday party early in the week was a who's who of politics and media that included Liz Truss, a video message from Donald Trump who called Farage a prophetic leader, and one James Heal. James, have you recovered yet?
Well, this is why I'm still hungover 2 days on, Patrick. I mean, it was a sort of mix between a political rally and a school reunion almost. You know, there was a disco at the end. They're doing Oops Upside Your Head.
Literally doing the rowing boat on the floor.
Absolutely.
Did you join in with that?
I did not. I was more a sort of a spectator, as it were, than a participant. But yes, it was 350 of Nigel Farage's nearest and dearest, and
including you.
Including me, apparently, made the
number 349.
Well, at least I didn't do what one MP did, who was actually asked to be invited on the day. So, But I mean, it was quite interesting. I mean, it was basically a kind of smaller, stripped down version of what he was like at Tory conference, really. And like a lot of the right wing kind of people of media backgrounds, business backgrounds, political, all sort of converging around him, and all really they're paying homage to him. And there were some strikingly surreal moments, such as I think I saw one point Liz Truss talking to Holly Valance, which was sort of when worlds collide. But I think it did show the energy was on show there. It was a real contrast with what I understand was the reception at the Carlton Club, where the Prime Minister was doing his political committee drinks with the Carlton, and that was described to me as very downbeat there. And on the same night across the city, Nigel Farage got a huge rapturous reception, not least probably helped by the fact that there was sort of vast quantities of champagne and lobster on display, etc.
And lobster, did you partake in the champagne and lobster, James?
I may have had one or two glasses, yes.
Well, very good. I note your non-denial on the lobster as well, so I'll keep a note of that. India, can you imagine anything better or worse than going to Nigel Farage's 60th? Are you disappointed you weren't invited?
I literally can't imagine anything worse. And looking at that guest list, they all look like they conceivably might have met out dogging while eating battery eggs. You know, I'm not casting any aspersions at all. I'm just saying, in my overactive imagination, that's the kind of vibe I get off a lot of the people on the guest list. So, yes, no, thank you.
James, was there a sort of political energy in the room, or was it sort of, you know, basically a knees up? You know, because there were lots of Tory MPs. That was the striking thing looking at the pictures. People like Dame Andrea Jenkins, Boris Johnson's biggest parliamentary supporter now, Nadine Dorries is gone. Liz Truss, I imagine there were quite a few other Tory MPs there as well. Yeah. Was there a sense of, you know, obviously it was a laugh, and there was a sense of pantomime about the whole affair, including Nigel Farage's own speech on about his own birthday. But was there a sort of sense that this is where the sort of energy is on the right of British politics is now, that sort of, you know, this was Tory MPs looking towards a new future for themselves and their own party? Or were they just enjoying the free champagne and lobster?
I think it was a bit of both, really. I think there's always been a strong social element to Farage's politics and UKIP and a lot of the right as well. And I think it was more kind of, it wasn't so much defector types as more social types. So someone like David Davis, who would never leave the Tory party, was there, but has known obviously Nigel Farage for 20 years or so. But I do think there was a political mission there. And one of the things I was told, and I'm going to write it up later, was one thing that Reform, for instance, are looking at is the 2026 Senate elections. In Wales, UKIP and then the Brexit Party and then Reform have always polled as well, if not slightly better than in England. And because you have a sort of proportional-based system, it means that Reform has had a good chance of getting more candidates elected there than under First Past the Post, as we've been talking about. And if they get that, I think they can qualify for a couple of £1 million in their equivalent to short money. And that can then fund the rest of the party throughout the whole of the UK. And so you used to have with UKIP, Brussels funding was used to fund UKIP's activities in Westminster. And so for them, Cardiff Bay will be the new Brussels, basically underpinning the rest of the movement. So there are, alongside all the champagne and the laughs, etc., there are some, you know, serious political conversations going there. And a lot of the people who did go there were also sort of big donors and such. So I think that that's one to really keep an eye on.
And did Farage himself say he's coming back?
No, he flirted with it. I mean, this is a great sort of one of the two great.
Such a terrible flirt.
Yes, he is. Yeah, so there's either when's the election and when's Farage coming back. I think that people talk about the return of Farage as though he needs to resign from something or some big event. Really, he can just lay down his GB News microphone, Cincinnati style with the plough, and do it anytime, really. I just think he would do it, you know, as soon as the election's called. Why would he want to give up broadcasting, the election can be next January. Why give it up 7 months early? I think he'll do it as and when the election's called and make some speeches and not do differently to what he's doing now.
Well, January is the dream story for Nigel Farage, of course. He can go on tour supporting his great friend Donald Trump and then return to menace the Conservative Party here. Right, in just a moment, we're going to be talking about the Netflix drama everybody's talking about, Scoop, that drama about the unforgettable Prince Andrew interview.
The allegations surrounding Jeffrey Epstein include his friend Prince Andrew.
Sam, let's stop pushing the palace. I want it for us.
You're chasing a story that we're never going to get.
This is the work. My job is booking the people we can't just call up.
Hello, everyone.
You have a problem that won't go away.
We're looking at options.
And let's remind ourselves of exactly how bonkers that extraordinary interview was.
I was with the children. I'd taken Beatrice to a Pizza Express in Woking for a party at, sort of 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And then because the Duchess was away, we have a simple rule in the family that when one's away, the other one's there. I was on terminal leave at the time from the Royal Navy, so therefore I was at home.
Why would you remember that so specifically? Why would you remember a Pizza Express birthday and being at home?
Because going to Pizza Express in Woking is an unusual thing for me to do. A very unusual thing for me to do.
India, will you be watching Scoop?
It's extraordinary, isn't it, hearing that clip, how he, you can hear in his voice that he thinks, job done, I've exonerated myself, excellent. And he's so completely unaware of the disaster that's about to unfold. But anyway, no, I won't be watching it because I think, as all the reviewers have pointed out this morning, it's mistitled for a start. It wasn't a scoop.
Well,
a scoop would have.
That's exactly scoop what Hugo Rifkin says. He doesn't.
Yeah, a scoop would have said. A scoop would have said, "I remember Virginia Giuffre very well, and yes, I was there, and I went to all his parties, and you know, there we are." That would have been a scoop. It wasn't a scoop. And also, having watched the original, the kind of indelible original, I don't feel that I need to. I feel I know what I need to know. Really,
do you agree, James? I mean. I'm not sure I would watch. Actually, no. I would watch a Netflix dramatization of you writing a Spectator column. But that's essentially what this is. It's a sort of film about the journalistic process, which is probably why it's been covered so extensively by the papers. But especially when the ending, as India says, isn't a great revelation. It's just sort of Prince Andrew makes a bit of a wally of himself. You can sort of understand why people might be underwhelmed by it.
Yeah, first of all, I have seen it. We did a Spectator.
Have you?
Yeah, so I've seen it, and I did enjoy
thank
it.
Thank you very much for the invite, James, but there you go.
I'll sort that out next time, actually. But, I mean, first of all, we'll say I've actually been to that Pizza Express in Woking, because the night the interview aired, I got sent down as the most junior member of the Mail on Sunday hack team to go down to Woking and before it aired, and they were fairly baffled as to why I wanted to see their records from 2001 to ask if actually Andrew had been there.
Did they keep the records?
Of course they didn't. No, it was the kind of classic assignment you send the most junior member of the MOS team to. But yeah, I do agree with India that I think the best moments, unfortunately, were the original interview, because how on earth could you top that? I mean, Rufus Sewell is fantastic as Prince Andrew, but really the original is, you know, just so jaw-dropping that you couldn't really top that. The other thing I think perhaps is there was a sort of missed opportunity with the conversations between two of the comms aides to Prince Andrew, Amanda Thirsk and Jason Stein. And Jason Stein resigned over it, and because he thought it was a bad idea. And so the interview was going ahead. And I think there could be more debate around that bit about what did the palace actually think Andrew knew and what. There seems to be this sort of suggestion that Amanda Thirsk just believed everything Prince Andrew said. And I think that a better interrogation of the kind of thinking of the palace and that would have been much more interesting to do, because as you say, a lot of journalism, frankly, is quite boring. And if you want to make it into film, it doesn't necessarily go along as a great drama, but a kind of interrogation of the palace's point of view might have been an interesting angle to include in it.
Is Jason Stein depicted in the film?
He is. He ought to be very flattered by it because he looks fantastic. But of course, then what, 3 years on later, went on to work for Liz Truss in the mini budget.
He's seen some stuff, Jason Stein. But it is interesting, as you say, because I remember at the time reading about Jason Stein's resignation. Obviously, he's a well-known figure in Westminster, used to be Amber Rudd's spin doctor. So, and the sum of his advice was basically to Prince Andrew, how about you just shut up for a while? And you know, go away for a bit and try and re-enter public life in a dignified way. And as you say, that was an interesting tension in the advice Prince Andrew was getting. What do you think, India, from what you've seen of the trailer and of Gillian Anderson's depiction of Emily Maitlis? Because having seen The Crown, I can't
escape... She's too like Thatcher.
Yeah, she's depicting Emily Maitlis as Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, she is. She is. It's once you notice it, it's unavoidable. I tell you what is amazing, though, and which I will continue be watching tonight again, is the Netflix adaptation of Ripley with Andrew Scott. Patricia Highsmith's novels. It's so fantastic. I recommend it so strongly. It's absolutely amazing.
And James, do you agree with me on Gillian Anderson as Emily Maitlis? Was that something that was evident when you watched the whole thing?
Yeah, I think it was sort of very Thatcher-esque, and I think it perhaps didn't get across her full nature as a journalist and person. It seemed a bit cold. She has this dog which she walks around with a lot. And so that was one of the bits. I didn't think of it as Emily Maitlis. I thought of Gillian. I thought it was just Margaret Thatcher, basically.
I think maybe Gillian Anderson is revealing herself to have one English accent, and it just happens to be Margaret Thatcher's. Any other journalistic enterprises you'd like to see dramatised, India?
I'd probably watch a dramatised version of the Liz Truss interlude.
Well, we're speaking to exactly the right man, because James Heal, of course, Liz Truss's official biographer, one half of, well, not official, unauthorised and unwelcomed biographer, James Heal, with Harry Cole, our News UK colleague from The Sun. Have you sold the film rights to that book yet, James?
I'm not sure what's currently the stage of that. So,
that sounds like a yes.
There's a sort of rival, there's some different productions going on with different things. So a bit like with Scoop, where there's actually, there's another one.
There's an Amazon Prime thing.
There's
an Amazon
one and a
Netflix one. So, we'll see what's at with those. But I think Liz Truss would be great on the small screen or the big screen, whatever.
Although who would play her? Quite hard to cast.
I mean, maybe Gillian Anderson, maybe it's keeping up.
She's available to play all female prime ministers, and Theresa May as well, when they finally dramatise that. Well, I'm delighted to have got the scoop, James, that you're subject to a bidding war for the rights to your book. But don't worry, I won't press you. I know it's awfully embarrassing talking about how successful you are on national radio. Thank you.
You did so well, Patrick.
Stop it. That was India Knight and James Heal from The Spectator. Remember, you can read India every week in the Sunday Times. Just pick up a copy of the paper or get yourself a digital subscription. We've got a fantastic offer on at the moment. 3 months for just £1. Up next, why borders explain everything.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Big Thing.
Yes, bit of Madonna on a Friday morning, but, and how's this for a segue, it's not just the Queen of Pop losing her mind over the borderline. Those sometimes arbitrary squiggles on the Atlas have created a global community of nations, but they've also caused division, hatred and war, and who drew them anyway? So in today's big thing at 11 o'clock, I'm going to examine this question, which explains a great deal of why our politics is such a mess. And I'm going to look at six of the borders that explain everything with John Elledge, whose book, The History of the World in 47 Borders, is out later this month. How are you, John?
I'm very good. Thank you very much for having me in. Delighted to hear Madonna on a Friday morning. I think that was on the first album I ever bought, that song.
Really? God, John, yeah. You're outing yourself as a...
I know. It's not what you'd expect of me, I think. But
Well, as a notoriously cool guy, John, I'm shocked. Just before we get into the specifics, what drove you to write a book about borders?
I'd sort of been interested in it and exploring it for a while before I sort of realised it. So, like, many years ago when I was at the New Statesman, where we first met, indeed, I used to write a website called City Metric, for which I did a sort of regular slot called Boundary Issues, which was about stupid lines on maps. I did an entry on the town of Bala in the southern Netherlands, which is became one of the entries in the book. But it's just something I'd written a lot about without kind of realising it was a theme. And when I was scratching around for something to propose as next book, my late partner Agnes said, "You do realise there's a book in Borders?" And I just thought that'd be a really fun thing to do because it's a way of covering lots of things I'm interested in, like history and geography and human stupidity, and then pretending it's a coherent subject.
And she was right. She was right.
She was dead right. Yeah.
And there are 47 of them in your book. I wish we could discuss all 47. We're going to look at six instead. And we're going to start exactly where we're sat right now, in London.
The houses of Metroland never got as far as Verney Junction. Grass triumphs, and I must say, I'm rather glad.
All I'm saying is, I do not mince around the bushes.
Mince.
Gossiping.
Good word.
With the greatest, most cosmopolitan, multiracial, generous-hearted city on earth.
The policy to expand the ultra-low emission zone is the right one.
ULEZ was the reason that we lost the by-election in Uxbridge.
So that, of course, was Sir John Betjeman, Gemma Collins from The Only Way is Essex, Boris Johnson, Steve Khan and Keir Starmer, together at last. John, it's a big question, this. Where does London begin and end? So we're sat at the south end of London Bridge. Over the river is the City of London. We're in Greater London, which encompasses bits of historic counties like Surrey and Essex and places that don't really feel like London at all. As a Romford boy, you'll know this well. So where does London begin and end, and why is this an important question?
So this is one that's very dear to my heart because, as you noted, I do come from Romford, which is on the edge of Greater London. It is technically inside London, but it's also the most Essex place in the universe. Like I used to, as a teenager, drink in the bars that would later be made famous by Cowie, where Gemma Collins found her fame. And so, like, you know, when I was a slightly pretentious, bookish, nerdy teenager, it was very important to me that I lived in London, not Essex.
Wow.
Even though that's kind of like an absurd distinction to make. The thing I find interesting about this one is, like, there is a proper answer. Like, you know, the Greater London boundary is the official answer to where London begins and ends. But if you look at polling of how people kind of perceive London, it doesn't really map on to, like, how people feel about it. Like, a lot of people would think of somewhere like Romford as being outside the city, and think instead of boundaries via, I don't know, postcodes, as often comes up.
And indeed, the MP for Romford, Andrew Rosendell, has called for the borough of Havering, in which Romford is part, to secede from Greater London altogether.
Yes.
Hexit.
The campaign for Hexit, yeah.
And it's interesting because this also applies to other cities. And, you know, we have psychological ideas and cultural ideas of what a city is, but Old Trafford isn't in Manchester. The Arch at La Défense is not in Paris. Las Vegas Strip isn't in Las Vegas.
Miami Beach isn't Miami.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
It is.
Does it matter?
So it does matter in terms of exciting things like governance. So London actually doesn't do a bad job of, like, drawing a line around roughly where London is. Like, there's a large chunk of sort of Surrey suburbia and bits of, like, the central line that are, like, physically attached to London, but outside it. But generally speaking, like, the physical footprint of London and the official boundary are not far off each other. If you look, like, at somewhere like Paris, where the official city boundary is much, much tighter, it's effectively, like, zones 1 and 2 of London. One of the impacts this has had is, like, the Paris metro barely goes outside those borders, the old city walls from the 1850s, I think, which means that you end up with, like, the suburbs, the banlieue, are kind of neglected because they've just not been, until relatively recently, they've just not really been governed as part of the city.
And London is an interesting example. We heard from John Betjeman well, the ghost of John Betjeman at the very start of that montage we played, he was obviously very evocatively writing about Metroland, you know, the bits of outer London that sprung up around the Metropolitan Railway and now we'd say other tube lines. And it's sort of London developed almost in response to infrastructure rather than the infrastructure being imposed on London. Our idea of London is almost a consequence of where the railways went, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that's true, yeah. I mean, one of the reasons that Metroland is northwest, that is seen as much more a part of London, I think, than the suburbs in other directions. If you think of, like, I mean, it's a bit different now with the Overground, but when I was a kid, like, South London was off the map because it wasn't on the tube map. So you get the jokes about cabbies not wanting to go south of the river. I really think that relates at least in part to the fact that South London just wasn't on a lot of people's mental map, even if you had a car. So, yeah, I do think it matters in terms of sort of planning of a city, but also there's no right answer. But where you draw the line has political consequences. Like, if London had been drawn more tightly, like Paris or New York, then you'd probably never have a Conservative mayor.
Because it was Boris Johnson's donut, famously, with the outer London boroughs. Let's quickly talk about another capital city, Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., capital of the United States of America, heart and center of the land of liberty.
The District of Columbia has spent 206 years yielding to people who would deny them the vote. I yield you no ground.
Even when I was in the military on active duty, I could vote. And when I arrived in D.C., suddenly I realized that I didn't have my full freedom.
So D.C., the border you write about in the book, the physical border itself, quite weird. Three sides, like a square, then the squiggly path of the Potomac River. What this really matters, though, is the politics of the situation. It's not a state. It's the, you know, D.C. Capital Territory. They don't have votes in the Electoral College.
No, they do in the Electoral
College. They don't have representation
in Congress.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So, or they don't have senators.
Historically, when it was first created, I don't think they had anything. Like, since then, they've got an elected mayor. They do now have votes in the Electoral College for the presidency, but there is a rule that they can never be more than the smallest state. So even if there were millions upon millions of people squeezed into D.C., they would still have the exact same Electoral College vote as Wyoming, where there's like six people. The reason I find this one interesting is because it was kind of created as a sort of political fudge. It was like because the US the Congress in early years kind of kept getting chased out of places by soldiers who hadn't been paid their wages for the Revolutionary War, and the state governments were not supporting the Congress against them, so they decided they needed their own territory where they kind of controlled stuff, and it was put in what was then the South as part of a compromise later memorialized in the musical Hamilton, in the song The Room Where It Happens, the compromise of 1790 it was, wasn't it? But it meant carving a chunk of space out of Virginia on the south side of the river and Maryland on the north side. All the government bodies went on the north side of the river, and the Virginians were suddenly like, well, hang on, we don't have any representation. We've been banned from getting, for various reasons, they've been kind of banned from getting any direct involvement in the government, or they weren't benefiting from the presence of the government on the other side of the river. And a lot of these guys at this point in history had slaves, and they were like, well, we're kind of like, we can't vote on this issue, which is clearly tearing the country apart. So I've forgotten the exact date, the 1840s sometime, I think, there was an event called the Retrocession, in which the Virginian side of the river just went back to the state of Virginia. So instead of this kind of square, which is what it originally was, you kind of get the square of a chunk bitten out of it, entirely because these guys in Virginia were like, well, we really like our right to keep other human beings as slaves. We would like to keep that. So they demanded to be let out of the District of Columbia. It's all quite messed up.
Do you think we'll ever see DC become a state, or are the political ramifications of that just too tricky?
It's difficult because, I mean, in the same way, like this kind of like no low level, not quite corruption, but pork barrel politics, put it that way, in self-interest in the creation of DC in the first place from a number of politicians. I think that's now blocking it from kind of solving the kind of democratic deficit, because if it became a state, that would mean two more Democratic senators, Democratic Party senators, and congressmen, and obviously the Republicans don't want that. If it rejoined Maryland, it would stop Maryland being, you know, it's mostly Democratic, but occasionally it's marginal, and the Republicans don't want that either. So it's stuck. There's like a population of about over 500,000 people, a very African-American city as well, who don't have representation in the United States legislature. And that seems immensely messed up to me.
It is immensely messed up. And for that reason, we're probably going to see that weird square of the chunk bit out of it persist. Mm. Now, let's head a little bit closer to home again. Our third border is here.
Tony Blair says there will not be a united Ireland in the lifetime of people in Ireland. We say the exact opposite.
Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom because that is the wish of the majority of people who live here.
After a 30-year winter of sectarian violence, Northern Ireland today has the promise of a springtime of peace.
We will under no circumstances have a hard border. There will be no physical checks or infrastructure at the border in Northern Ireland.
The past cannot be changed or cannot be undone. But what we can do is build a better future.
Now, John, I'm wary about two Englishmen, even if I do have my Irish passport in my wallet, and a name like Patrick McGuire, trying to compress the history of Northern Ireland into a couple of minutes. Some listeners will know the history of this border. Some will have had it thrust upon them in the Brexit years. That's certainly the case for lots of politicians on both sides of the Commons. But why is it, simply as possible, why did it end up where it is?
Well, thank you for that question on a Friday morning, which I was terrified of this one. I actually got quite far into the book before my editor said to me, you do realise you are going to have to do both Ireland and Israel. You can't get away with not doing them. Which was mean of her. But yeah, so like the history sort of starts in the 12th century when a deposed king, regional king, I think, of Ireland, Dermot McMurrough, has been deposed, and he asked for the help of Henry II to regain his throne. And Henry II is then not just King of England, he's the Angevin Emperor. He has an empire across the Channel with much of Western France. But this is kind of the beginning of not even English, British involvement in Ireland, because it's a sort of Anglo-Norman Welsh alliance to just show up and then never really leaves. But that's kind of like feudal politics of the same sort that's happening all over Europe. Mm. There's a big shift in the 16th and 17th centuries at a point where I think England is worried about, well, first it's the Reformation, and secondly, England is worried about attacks from Catholic powers like Spain. So both the English and Scottish crowns both begin to what are called plantations, which is literally the settlement of good British Protestant types on the soil of Ireland in an attempt to push the native population west to the other side of the river, the name which escapes
me. The Ban.
Yes. What's the phrase? To hell or to Connaught. To hell or to Connaught they were sent. So it was like, it was basically what we would now term ethnic cleansing. It didn't really work because there weren't enough English or Scottish settlers to do the job, and they tended to marry. It tended to be men marrying Irish women, so the kids were effectively Irish. But you ended up with this kind of resident Protestant population that was very, it was more successfully done in Ulster than anywhere else. So when you get to the 20th century and Ireland breaks away from the UK, there is a population in the north that's been there for 300 years, considers itself British, and is on both, and is willing to kind of arm to fight to remain British.
Yeah, the original Ulster Volunteer Force.
Yeah, I think this is so. I mean, a lot of this history, if I'm honest, I didn't know that much about it until I had to write.
Well, the campaign for Ulster Home Rule, the Ulster campaign against Home Rule in the early 20th century. There's a historian called Dan Jackson, who's written a PhD thesis about this. It's very, very expensive on Amazon. I haven't bought it. But it was a massive, massive domestic cause. You know, there was the threat of sort of violent insurrection and civil war in Northern Ireland, but not from the side we now commonly associate, you know, the Republican side. It was the Loyalist side who wanted to...
And it was on both sides of the Irish Sea as well. Mm. Like the
Ulster militias were very big in...
Yeah, exactly. Like, something I hadn't appreciated until upsettingly recently is how, like, in the years before World War One, which we all just associate with kind of glorious sun-soaked garden party, you know, Downton Abbey and so on, these islands were on the verge of civil war.
And in one respect, for David Lloyd George and Herbert Asquith, the war was a welcome distraction from all of that. So the First World War, and it's Lloyd George who eventually reaches the compromise of a partition of Ireland. And the really interesting thing about the border as we currently know it is that it was meant to move. They were meant to set up border commissions that would sort of adjust it to make sure that majority Catholic places, as demographic changed, ended up back in Southern Ireland, as it was then known.
Well, they did fiddle the numbers, didn't they? Because originally they were looking at just kind of carving out Ulster, like in the period where they're talking about Home Rule, there were going to be two parliaments on the island of Ireland. There was going to be one for Ulster and one for the other three provinces. But then the unionist population in Ulster were a bit worried that that wasn't going to be unionist enough. So the free western counties of Ulster ended up attached to what later became the Republic.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting. Its ramifications are still being felt today. Mm. Obviously, in time, in 10, 20 years, Irish nationalists hope that that border will no longer exist. You know, in the UK's 2021 census found for the first time, Catholics outnumber those identifying as Protestant. Sinn Féin, now the largest party in Northern Ireland, won the highest fair votes in local elections, have the First Minister. You know, let's not get into predicting when and if unification will happen, but it's a border that may disappear in our lifetimes.
Mm. I was very struck when Michelle O'Neill became... It is Michelle O'Neill.
It is Michelle O'Neill.
That would be so embarrassing. When she became First Minister of Northern Ireland, there were pictures of her sort of laughing and joking with the King. And it's kind of reassuring, given that the border kind of has come back into the discussion after being out of it for 25 years, thankfully, to see that that's kind of the level on which this politics is still conducted, you know?
Yeah, but it will doubtless be an incredibly fraught conversation as and when we get to that referendum. Now, we're going to go to the Middle East.
Where there was no hope for peace, there is now hope.
America has long been committed to bringing peace to this troubled region.
They know there's no sense in an endless tug of war over common ground.
The Middle East is going through a transformation that will play out for a generation, rooted in conflicts that date back millennia.
As far as settlements, I'd like to see you hold back on settlements for a little bit. Doesn't sound too optimistic, but that's...
We cannot give up on a two-state solution. Israel and Palestinians equally deserve to live in safety, dignity, and peace.
So that was a rogues gallery of presidents: Nixon, Reagan, Clinton, Obama, Trump and Biden, all saying peace is coming to the Middle East soon, very soon. And John, borders really do explain why this region, partly explain rather, why this region is such a mess, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's strange to say it, but it does kind of feel like a lot of the Middle East today is still feeling the sort of fallout from the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Which is where the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 comes in.
So what I find interesting about Sykes-Picot is it is the one that everyone's, you know, people can name it. It's the one people can cite, like during the, when ISIS was a thing in like 2014, 2015, you get there, so the person who was calling himself Caliph was talking about bulldozing Sykes-Picot. The line that actually exists on the map, though, is not the one they drew.
Really? And so just put bluntly, it is the reason why you look at the Middle East and all the lines are weirdly straight.
That's a problem all over the world. That's so many colonial borders. That happens in North America, Australia, Africa. But the particular the line in the sand is generally perceived to be the one that runs between Syria and Iraq, which carved the Middle East into a French mandate on the Syrian side and a British mandate on the Iraqi one. That was the one that ISIS was quite keen to demolish. But as I say, like, it wasn't the only agreement that the Entente powers made to divide up the Ottoman Empire should it fall. It wasn't the last one. It wasn't the line we actually got. But it was the one that was revealed in the communist Russian newspaper Pravda that they'd drawn. And I think that was the moment when the West Arab allies realised that they'd been betrayed by Britain and France, basically. And also, this is a thing that comes up in a number of entries in the book. It's like, often we have words that are attached to particular borders or particular developments in political history, like the Peace of Westphalia or the Mason-Dixon line is another, where if you actually look into it, the idea we have of what they mean is not what they actually mean on the ground or in a treaty or something. It's just become sort of basket term for a whole historical process. And I think Sykes-Picot is that.
It's sort of the process by which the Allied powers, United Kingdom, France, with the assent of the Russians and the Italians, basically just carving up the Middle East.
And Britain and France had allies inside, Arab allies inside what was then the Ottoman Empire, basically doing our dirty work, trying to bring the empire down from within. And the deal was that in exchange, they would get their own countries. And what they didn't realise at the time was Britain and France had other plans.
Mm. And they sort of did that with no little heed for local politics, ethnic divisions, and, you know, those things have reverberated over the past very difficult century in the Middle East. Right, next, let's head east.
We have stopped the shooting. That means much to the fighting men and their families.
and it will allow some of the grievous wounds of Korea to heal.
In accordance with the truce agreement, the opposing forces now pulled back from one another. The open ground left between was to become the demilitarized zone, or DMZ.
Now that was General Mark Clark declaring the end of US fighting in the Korean War and the creation of what we now know as the DMZ between the two of them. Talk us through that.
Okay, so, oh God, that's a big question for a minute and a half, isn't it? it's after World War II. Korea has been dominated by the Empire of Japan for a generation. So there's kind of no homegrown government. All the rulers have been in exile. And it's, as with Germany in the West, it's been divided between spheres of influence. You've got the Soviets in the North and the Americans in the South. And that's a pretty unstable situation. And it kind of wobbles along for a bit. And I think it's 1950, with the backing of communist China. The communists take over North Korea and march south. And they get almost all the way down the peninsula before the US, with UN backing, goes in and sort of pushes them back. And after a couple of years, there's a stalemate, which people remember as being like it's the 38th parallel. But that was kind of the treaty line between the two spheres of influence. It's not actually the border existing. The border
it's not a straight line.
Much wobblier, yeah. And there is this zone with nobody in it that's been completely evacuated. And you've got armies staring at each other, one of whom has the bomb and the other has the backing of a nuclear power, basically trolling each other. Okay, there was at one point they're kind of competing for the biggest flagpole. At another, they're kind of broadcasting, the North is broadcasting, communist music and, paeans to, how great the glorious leader is, while the South is playing K-pop back at them. and at one point, we nearly get World War III over a tree.
Really?
Yeah. So, I love this story. It's kind of upsetting, but it's also funny. There is a tree that's blocking, in the DMZ, that is blocking a sight line from a US-UN gatehouse or something. So they go in to prune it. Northern troops kind of pop out and go, what are you doing? They refuse to move, so they start attacking them with their own axes. Two young American lads are killed.
Wow.
A couple of days later, the US is back with, men with mines strapped to their chest, attack helicopters, a full-on military force to get rid of a single poplar tree. And it's just a history of incidents like this. And as with a lot of stuff involving North Korea, it seems quite funny, but also it's absolutely terrifying.
But also it could slip into life and death at any moment.
Yeah, World War III could start there.
And of course, it's become a tourist attraction. Donald Trump was there not long ago, also a stretch of beautifully untouched wildlife as well, apparently.
Yeah.
Right, to conclude, we're going to hop on one of Kim's rockets and head to space.
2-1-0, all engines running.
To all you kids down there, I was once a child with a dream, looking up to the stars. Now, I'm an adult in a spaceship.
You look at this thing and you see how small you are, you see that the world is big, you see the atmosphere is small, you see that there are no boundaries, no lines, no national state. We are one world. This is one planet. We should have a lot of unifiers.
So you heard there from Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos, who both flew to space last year. Or did they? Do we know, John, where the border between Earth and space is? And in this age of space exploration, weapons being fired from space, space being commercialised, do we need to decide this pretty sharpish?
So, there is an argument about it. Richard Branson made it up there first. In the middle of, I think it was the final of the 2022 Euros. So nobody was actually watching when he was broadcasting live from space. And then to make matters worse, Bezos's people sort of put out a release saying, you didn't really go to space, though, did you? Because he didn't make it past what's called the Kármán line. Which was a theoretical point at which, aeronautics turns into astronautics. It's where you can't just fly a conventional plane anymore. And it turns out it's quite contested whether this line is the boundary of space, exactly where it is, and so on and so on. The reason this would matter is that, if it's not space, that's a country's own airspace, and you have to kind of respect their sovereign airspace. If it is space, you can stick a satellite up there in geostationary orbit and spy on them. So that's where kind of the security concerns come in, and it's not just rich guys showing off.
And where do you think, is there a logical point at which we can say, yes, that is space, it's no longer the Earth's atmosphere?
Not really. It's all, it's a judgment call. There's five or six different lines in common use. And the most commonly used one turns out to be like a fairly arbitrary line and then rounded up. So it is entirely a judgment call, I'm afraid. It does feel like something we're going to have to come to an international agreement on at some point.
And that is an increasingly difficult thing to do. Right, that's all we've got time for with John Elledge. That was the six borders that explain the politics of the world. John's written a book about 47 of them. Tell us the title, where we can buy it.
It's called A History of the World in 47 Borders. It is officially out at the end of the month, but copies are already starting to pop up now. So please go and buy it. You'll make me very happy.
And John deserves to be very happy indeed. My former colleague and current friend, John Elledge. Really good to hear from you. Well, that's all we've got time for on today's episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits. We'll be back tomorrow with my last podcast of the week. In the meantime, make sure you like, share, subscribe and follow wherever you get your podcast from.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.